Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. So we've been going through Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, a New York Times number one bestseller from 2004. What it does is go into a very deep foundational level for why we're in the kind of debt we are individually, nationally, and globally. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. And I will continue where I left off in the last show from Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I highly recommend that you read. The glories of Colombia's history are counterbalanced by hatred and violence. The seat of the Spanish viceroy was also home to the Inquisition. Magnificent forts, haciendas, and cities were constructed over the bones of Indian and African slaves. The treasures carried on the golden galleons, sacred objects and masterpieces of art that had been melted down for easy transport, were ripped from the hearts of ancient peoples. The proud cultures themselves were laid to waste by conquistador swords and diseases. More recently, a controversial presidential election in 1945 resulted in a deep division between political parties and led to La Violencia from 1948 to 1957, during which more than 200,000 people died. Despite the conflicts and ironies, both Washington and Wall Street historically have viewed Colombia as an essential factor in promoting Pan-American political and commercial interests. This is due to several factors. In addition to Colombia's critical geographic location, including the perception that leaders throughout the hemisphere look to Bogota for inspiration and guidance, and the fact that the country is both a source of many products purchased in the United States, coffee, bananas, textiles, emeralds, flowers, oil, and cocaine, and a market for our goods and services. One of the most important services we sold to Colombia during the late 20th century was engineering and construction expertise. Colombia was typical of many places where John worked. It was relatively easy to demonstrate that the country could assume vast amounts of debt and then repay these debts from the benefits realized both from the projects themselves and from the country's natural resources. Thus, huge investments in electrical power grids, highways, and telecommunications would help Colombia open up its vast gas and oil resources and its largely undeveloped Amazonian territories. These projects, in turn, would generate the income necessary to pay off the loans plus interest. Well, that was the theory. However, the reality, consistent with the true intent around the world, was to subjugate Bogota to further the global empire in the United States. John's job, as it had been in so many places, was to present the case for exceedingly large loans. Colombia did not have the benefit of a Torrijos, therefore John felt he had no choice but to develop inflated economic and electric load forecasts. With the exception of occasional bouts of guilt over his job, Colombia became a personal refuge for John. Anne and John had spent a couple of months there in the early 1970s and had even made a down payment on a small coffee farm located in the mountains along the Caribbean coast. John thinks their time together during that period came as close as anything could to healing the wounds they had inflicted on each other over the preceding years. Ultimately, however, the wounds went too deep, and it was not until after their marriage fell apart that John became truly acquainted with the country. During the 1970s, Maine had been awarded a number of contracts to develop various infrastructure projects, including a network of hydroelectric facilities and the distribution systems to transport the electricity from deep in the jungle to cities high in the mountains. John was given an office in the coastal city of Barranquilla, and it was there in 1977 that he met a beautiful Colombian woman who would become a powerful agent of change in his life. Paula had long blonde hair and striking green eyes, not what most foreigners expect in a Colombian. Her mother and father had immigrated from northern Italy, and in keeping with her heritage, she became a fashion designer. She went a step further, however, and built a small factory where her creations were transformed into clothes, which she then sold at upscale boutiques throughout the country, as well as in Panama and Venezuela. She was a deeply compassionate person who helped John get through some of the personal trauma of his broken marriage and begin dealing with some of his attitudes towards women, which had affected him so negatively. She also taught him a great deal about the consequences of the actions he took in his job. As John said before, life is composed of a series of coincidences over which we have no control. For him, those included being raised as the son of a teacher of an all-male prep school in rural New Hampshire, meeting Anne and her uncle Frank, the Vietnam War, and meeting Einar Greve. However, once one is presented with such consequences, one faces choices. How one responds, the actions taken in the face of coincidences, make all the difference. For example, excelling at that school, marrying Anne, entering the Peace Corps, and choosing to become an economic hitman, all these decisions had brought John to his current place in life. Paula was another coincidence, and her influence would lead John to take actions that changed the course of his life. Until he met her, he had pretty much gone along with the system. He often found himself questioning what he was doing, sometimes feeling guilty about it, yet he always discovered a way to rationalize staying in the system. Perhaps Paula just happened along at the right time. It is possible that John would have taken the plunge anyway, that his experiences in Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Panama would have nudged him into action. But he is certain that even as one woman, Claudine, had been instrumental in persuading him to join the ranks of economic hitmen, another, Paula, was the catalyst he needed at that time. She convinced him to go deep into himself and see that he would never be happy as long as he continued in that role. And I will return to this story in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. "I'll be frank," Paula said one day while we were sitting in a coffee shop. The Indians and all the farmers who live along the river you are damming hate you. Even people in the cities who aren't directly affected sympathize with the guerrillas who've been attacking your construction camp. Your government calls these people communists, terrorists, and narcotics traffickers, but the truth is they're just people with families who live on lands your company is destroying. John had told her about Manuel Torres. He was an engineer employed at Maine and one of the men recently attacked by guerrillas at their hydroelectric dam construction site. Manuel was a Colombian citizen who had a job because of a policy prohibiting the company from sending U.S. citizens to that site. Some of them, including their Colombian counterparts, refer to it as the Colombians are expendable doctrine, and it symbolized an attitude John had grown to hate. His feelings towards such policies were making it increasingly difficult for him to live with himself. According to Manuel, they fired AK-47s into the air and at his feet, John told Paula. He sounded calm when he told me about it, but I know he was most hysterical. They didn't shoot anyone, just gave them that letter and sent them downriver in their boats. My God, Paula exclaimed. The poor man was terrified. Of course he was, John told her, that he had asked Manuel whether he thought they were FARC or M19, referring to two of the most infamous Colombian guerrilla groups. And he said neither. He told me that he believes what they said in that letter. Paula picked up the newspaper John had brought and read the letter aloud. We, who work every day just to survive, swear on the blood of our ancestors that we will never allow dams across our rivers. We are simple Indians and mestizos, but we would rather die than stand by as our land is flooded. We warn our Colombian brothers, stop working for the construction companies. She set the paper down. What did you say to him? John hesitated, but only for a moment. I had no choice. I had to toe the company line. I asked him if he thought that sounds like a letter a farmer would write. She sat watching John patiently. He just shrugged. Their eyes met. Oh, Paula, I detest myself for playing this role. What did you do next? She pressed. I slammed my fist on the desk. I intimidated him. I asked him whether farmers with AK-47s made any sense to him. Then I asked if he knew who invented the AK-47. Did he? Yes, but I could hardly hear his answer. A Russian, he said. Of course, I assured him that he was right, that the inventor had been a communist named Kalashnikov, a highly decorated officer in the Red Army. I brought him around to understand that the people who wrote that note were communists. Do you believe that? She asked. Her question stopped John. How could he answer honestly? John recalled Iran and the time Yamin described him as a man caught between two worlds, a man in the middle. In some ways, John wished he had been in that camp when the guerrillas attacked, or that he was one of the guerrillas. An odd feeling crept over him, a sort of jealousy for Yamin and Doc and the Colombian rebels. These were men with convictions. They had chosen real worlds, not a no man's territory somewhere in between. I have a job to do, John said at last. She smiled gently. I hate it, John continued. He thought about the men whose images had come to him so often over the years, Tom Paine and other Revolutionary War heroes, pirates and frontiersmen. They stood at the edges, not in the middle. They had taken stands and lived with the consequences. Every day I come to hate my job a little more. She took his hand. Your job? Their eyes met and held. John understood the implication. Myself. She squeezed his hand and nodded slowly. John felt an immediate sense of relief just admitting it. What will you do, John? He had no answer. The relief turned into defensiveness. John stammered out the standard justifications, that he was trying to do good, that he was exploring ways to change the system from within, and the old standby that if he quit, someone even worse would fill his shoes. But he could see from the way she watched him that she was not buying it. Even worse, John knew that he was not buying it either. She had forced him to understand the essential truth. It was not his job, but him that was to blame. "What about you?" John asked at last. "What do you believe?" She gave a little sigh and released his hand, asking, "You're trying to change the subject?" John nodded. "Okay," she agreed, "under one condition, that we'll return to it another day." She picked up a spoon and appeared to examine it. "I know that some of the guerrillas have trained in Russia and China." She lowered the spoon into her café con leche, stirred, and then slowly licked the spoon. "What else can they do? They need to learn about modern weapons and how to fight the soldiers who've gone through your schools. Sometimes they sell cocaine in order to raise money for supplies. How else can they buy guns? They're up against terrible odds. Your World Bank doesn't help them defend themselves. In fact, it forces them into this position." She took a sip of coffee. "I believe their cause is just. The electricity will help only a few, the wealthiest Colombians, and thousands will die because the fish and water are poisoned after you build that dam of yours." Hearing her words so compassionately about the people who opposed John in particular caused his flesh to crawl. He found himself clawing at his forearms. "How do you know so much about the guerrillas?" Even as John asked it, he felt a sinking feeling, a premonition that he did not want to know the answer. "I went to school with some of them," she said. She hesitated, pushed her cup away. "My brother joined the movement." There it was. John felt absolutely deflated. He thought he knew all about her, but this, he had the fleeting image of a man coming home to find his wife in bed with another man. "How come you never told me?" "Seemed irrelevant. Why would I? It isn't something I brag about." She paused. "I haven't seen him for 2 years. He has to be very careful." "How do you know he's alive?" "I don't, except recently the government put him on a wanted list." "That's a good sign." John was fighting the urge to be judgmental or defensive. He hoped she could not discern his jealousy. "How did he become one of them?" John asked. Fortunately, she kept her eyes on the coffee cup. "Demonstrating outside the offices of an oil company, Occidental, I think, he was protesting drilling on indigenous lands in the forests of a tribe facing extinction, him and a couple dozen of his friends. They were attacked by the army, beaten and thrown into prison, for doing nothing illegal, mind you, just standing outside the building waving placards and singing." She glanced out a nearby window. "They kept him in jail for nearly 6 months. He never did tell us what happened there, but when he came out, he was a different person." And I'll return to the story after station identification. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. It was the first of many similar conversations with Paula, and John knows that these discussions set the stage for what was to follow. His soul was torn apart, yet he was still ruled by his wallet and by those other weaknesses the NSA had identified when they profiled him a decade earlier in 1968. By forcing him to see this and to confront the deeper feelings behind his fascination with pirates and other rebels, Paula helped him along the trail toward salvation. Beyond his own personal dilemmas, many times in Colombia also helped him comprehend the distinction between the old American Republic and the new global empire. The Republic offered hope to the world. Its foundation was moral and philosophical rather than materialistic. It was based on concepts of equality and justice for all. But it could also be pragmatic, not merely a utopian dream, but also a living, breathing, magnanimous entity. It could open its arms to shelter the downtrodden. It was an inspiration, and at the same time a force to reckon with. If needed, it could swing into action, as it had during World War II, to defend the principles for which it stood. The very institutions, the big corporations, banks, and government bureaucracies that threatened the Republic could be used instead to institute fundamental changes in the world. Such institutions possess the communications networks and transportation systems necessary to end disease, starvation, and even wars, if only they could be convinced to take that course. The global empire, on the other hand, is the Republic's nemesis. It is self-centered, self-serving, greedy, and materialistic, a system based on mercantilism. Like empires before, its arms open only to accumulate resources, to grab everything in sight, and stuff its insatiable maw. It will use whatever means it deems necessary to help its rulers gain more power and riches. Of course, in learning to understand this distinction, John also developed a clearer sense of his own role. Claudine had warned him. She had honestly outlined what would be expected of him if he accepted the job Maine offered. Yet it took the experience of working in countries like Indonesia, Panama, Iran, and Colombia in order for him to understand the deeper implications. And it took the patience, love, and personal stories of a woman like Paula. John was loyal to the American Republic, but what they were perpetuating through this new highly subtle form of imperialism was the financial equivalent of what they had attempted to accomplish militarily in Vietnam. If Southeast Asia had taught them that armies have limitations, the economists had responded by devising a better plan, and the foreign aid agencies and the private contractors who served them, or more appropriately, were served by them, had become proficient at executing that plan. In countries on every continent, John saw how men and women working for U.S. corporations, though not officially part of the EHM network, participated in something far more pernicious than anything envisioned in conspiracy theories. Like many of Maine's engineers, these workers were blind to the consequences of their actions, convinced that the sweatshops and factories that made shoes and automotive parts for their companies were helping the poor climb out of poverty, instead of simply burying them deeper in a type of slavery reminiscent of medieval manors and southern plantations. Like those earlier manifestations of exploitation, modern serfs or slaves were socialized into believing they were better off than the unfortunate souls who lived on the margins, in the dark hollows of Europe, in the jungles of Africa, or in the wilds of the American frontier. The struggle over whether John should continue at Maine or should quit had become an open battlefield. There was no doubt that his conscience wanted out, but that other side, what he liked to think of as his business school persona, was not so sure. John's own empire kept expanding. He added employees, countries, and shares of stock to his various portfolios and to his ego. In addition to the seduction of the money and lifestyle and the adrenaline high of power, he often recalled Claudine warning him that once he was in, he could never get out. Of course, Paula sneered at this. What would she know? John pointed out that Claudine had been right about a great many things. That was a long time ago. Lives change. Anyway, what difference does it make? You're not happy with yourself. What can Claudine or anyone else do to make things worse than that? It was a refrain Paula often came back to, and John eventually agreed. He admitted to her and to himself that all the money, adventure, and glamour no longer justified the turmoil, guilt, and stress. As a Maine partner, He was becoming wealthy, and he knew that if he stayed longer, he would be permanently trapped. One day, while they were strolling along the beach near the old Spanish fort at Cartagena, a place that had endured countless pirate attacks, Paula hit upon an approach that had not occurred to him. "What if you never say anything about the things you know?" she asked. "You mean just keep quiet?" "Exactly. Don't give them an excuse to come after you. In fact, give them every reason to leave you alone, to not muddy the water." It made a great deal of sense. John wondered why it never occurred to him before. He would not write books or do anything else to expose the truth as he had come to see it. He would not be a crusader. Instead, he would just be a person, concentrate on enjoying life, travel for pleasure, perhaps even start a family with someone like Paula. He had had enough. He simply wanted out. "Everything Claudine taught you is a deception," Paula added. "Your life's a lie." She smiled condescendingly. "Have you looked at your own resume recently?" John admitted he had not. "Do," she advised. "I read the Spanish version the other day. If it's anything like the English one, I think you'll find it very interesting." This leads to the deceptive resume. While John was in Colombia, word arrived that Jake Dauber had retired as Maine's president. As expected, Chairman and CEO Mac Hall appointed Bruno as Dauber's replacement. The phone lines between Boston and Barranquilla went crazy. Everyone predicted that John, too, would soon be promoted. After all, he was one of Bruno's most trusted protégés. These changes and rumors were an added incentive for John to review his own position. While still in Colombia, he followed Paula's advice and read the Spanish version of his resume. It shocked him. Back in Boston, he pulled out both the English original and a November 1978 copy of Mainlines, the corporate magazine. That edition featured him in an article entitled, "Specialists Offer Maine's Clients New Services." John had taken great pride in that resume and that article, and yet now, seeing them as Paula did, he felt a growing sense of anger and depression. The material in these documents represented intentional deceptions, if not lies, and these documents carried a deeper significance, a reality that reflected the times and reached to the core of the current march to global empire. They epitomized a strategy calculated to convey appearances, to shield an underlying reality. In a strange way, they symbolized the story of John's life, a glossy veneer covering synthetic surfaces. Of course, it did not give John any great comfort to know that he had to take much of the responsibility for what was included in his resume. According to standard operating procedures, he was required to constantly update both a basic resume and a file with pertinent backup information about clients served and the type of work done. If a marketing person or project manager wanted to include him in a proposal or to use his credentials in some other way, he could massage this basic data in a manner that emphasized his particular needs. For instance, the manager might choose to highlight John's experience in the Middle East or in making presentations before the World Bank and other multinational forums. Whenever this was done, that person was supposed to get John's approval before actually publishing the revised resume. However, since, like many other Maine employees, John traveled a great deal, exceptions were frequently made. Thus, the resume Paula suggested John look at and its English counterpart were completely new to him, although the information certainly was included in his file. And we will continue the story in the next show of The Confessions of an Economic Hitman. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.